Welcome to Top Advisor Marketing, where you will learn how to become a prolific online influencer, attract more ideal clients, and grow your practice. Brought to you by Top Advisor Podcasting, a done-for-you podcasting solution built just for trusted advisors. And now, your co-hosts of Top Advisor Marketing, Kirk Lowe and Matt Halloran.
Hello and welcome to another Top Advisor Marketing Radio podcast, where we bring the greatest minds in marketing in the financial services industry directly to you so that you can learn from seasoned experts like our guest today, who I've personally followed on LinkedIn for a really long time, personally referred her advisors to work with, because I truly think that what Susan Bradley has created as the founder and CEO of the Financial Transitionist Institute, which is a division of the Sudden Money Institute, which many of you have probably heard of the Sudden Money Institute, and we're going to dive into a little bit more about what her new specialty is, which is the Financial Transitionist Institute, really is all about. So, Susan, how are you today, and where are you talking to us from?
I'm fantastic. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm in beautiful, sunny Florida today.
Magnificent. And you travel a lot. In fact, the picture that we have accompanying this podcast is you just getting back from India. Would you mind telling our audience a little bit about that?
Yes. I had the honor of spending a month in India. Half of that time was in the rural area where the picture was taken of the Brahmastan of India, which is the center of India. And then the next half of the month, I was launching the Financial Transitionist Certification Program in India, and attended and gave many workshops, and was at the RIA Summit in Mumbai, and very impressed with the financial planning community of India. Just great people doing good work.
So besides India, where else have you opened up either a Sudden Money or the Financial Transitionist Institute?
Australia and Canada. We have people training in Scotland and New Zealand and Brazil, but we have more formalized business in four countries: Australia, U.S., Canada, and now India.
Well, let's talk about what you have created here, because, again, the focus of our podcasts is for financial services professionals from all over North America, and hopefully, well, people who speak English will understand a little bit more about great ways to position yourself in financial services. And I truly believe what you have created allows advisors to brand themselves in a truly unique way. So why don't we break that down a little bit? Tell us what the Financial Transitionist Institute is. Actually, before we get there, would you mind, how did the Sudden Money Institute begin, and then how did you make that transition to this new designation and this new training?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Sudden Money Institute began in June of 2000. So we're almost 17 years old at this point. And it was because I had written a book called Sudden Money, Managing a Financial Windfall. And I wrote that book because I wanted to know how to work with people when their money was changing in significant ways, either up or down. It was something that was disturbing me in some of the client situations I was seeing and reading about. And I felt like we needed that. I went to learn how to work with those people. We had no protocol at the time in the industry. So I explored that and wrote the book. I thought I was done and I would go back to my full-time practice, and which I loved. I've been a CFP since the early 80s and I love the profession. But my colleagues wanted to know more. I think people think that when you write a book that you become an expert. And I was just an explorer at the time, or maybe even a scout. Mm-hmm. I was just starting to learn as I put my process into practice. It was good, but there was still more. So as we gather together every year, we have a group that has been, some of the Sudden Money people have been coming to our events and part of our process for the full 17 years. And then over time, we realized the first 3 years, pretty much, we realized we were really talking about a bigger issue, and that was life transitions, change events that make life no longer what it was, but you're not where you're going to be. There's that empty space. That's the transition, a transit from one to another. Widows take about 6 to 7 years to make that transit. It's much longer than we think. It's more confusing than we think it should be. And the more we studied it, the more we realized that we really needed to know this as part of the process of working with clients as their expert guides through these life events. So as we moved further into it, we put an awful lot of time into it. The CFP board was great and would approve our conferences or our workshops for credit, but we had no way of explaining who we were. Saying I'm a sudden money advisor just kind of had a funny ring to it for many people. So we didn't do that. But we eventually felt like we really needed to concretize our work, and we created a certification, but we needed to know what we were going to call ourselves first. And the word transitionist came up. Had you ever heard of that word?
I don't know. Did you make that word up?
No.
Really?
It's funny. Somebody, one of our advisors called and said, I know who we are. We're transitionists. So I Googled it, and the definition of a transitionist is one who is skilled and trained to manage change. Voila, that's what we'd been doing at that point for about 12, 13 years. So, but we don't do it in general. We focus on financial transitions. So we had a very clear description of who we were. And then what we wanted to do is we wanted to really identify this as a specialized area of practice within the financial advice industry worldwide. So we looked into certifications, and that's a big, big commitment. So we mapped it out and made the commitment. And now we are in the process of recognition with FINRA. And I'm sure we'll get it because we've done all the pieces, which took a long time. And now some of the major broker dealers are approving it. So we're starting to make those inroads. And the public then has a way to say, I'm going through these big things. I really need help. Who knows about this? And all advisors now are saying, I work with people in transition, but only a few can say, I'm certified and I've spent a year and I'm tested and I have CEs and I have standards and code of conduct and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's absolutely phenomenal. And how often do you hold formal training here in the States?
At least three times a year. It's mostly virtual and on demand, and you're tested as you go.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the work is the real learning comes from working directly with your clients. The tools are pretty universal. They go across the whole range of business models. It's scalable. You could be a one-person shop, or you could be with a wirehouse or with a bank. Or an insurance company. It goes across the range there. It applies across net worth, gender, life event. So when we have a tool on communication, for instance, it's very easy for the people in training to go to existing clients as well as new clients and do a quick review on what would be important to the client about meetings and decisions and looking at and receiving information and recommendations. So it's experiential learning. That's a big deal.
Sure.
So people are doing their homework. They have six experiences in this tool and two in another, and they write it up and we discuss it in experience calls. So they're tracked all the way through. When they have on demand, they have to take a quiz afterwards. So we know that we took it because these are all CFP CE qualifying. So it's very formalized at this point. It took us a while. We were not always this formal. We were very developmental. In the times that might be a euphemism, we were trying to figure it out. We're trying to build a new specialized area of practice.
Okay.
That may, in fact, end up being a new profession. But right now, it's a specialized area of practice of wealth management.
So I get the certification or the education, for lack of a better description, as of right now where we stand today. What do you do to help advisors market themselves differently in the marketplace because they have this continuing education?
That's a really great question, because we had to, we've worked on that obviously for years. And in the beginning, sudden money was such a new term, and we had tons of media exposure. So people would come to the website and search the advisors, and that was a good source. It still is a source, but people are hiring a little differently than they did 15 years ago. So we have people learn their own version of our story. And we have them practice that, and we have a really beautiful infographic that they can use if they want. But it's all anchored in the belief that there are two sides of money, the technical side and the personal side. And people get that intuitively. You know, technical would be the taxes, the portfolio management, and formal financial planning, cash flow management, risk management, like that. The personal side is relationships and hopes and dreams and taboos and fears and self-esteem and stress. And it's interesting that our industries were really well developed around the technical side, with a nod for the personal, a respect that it existed. Certainly it wasn't ignored, but we had no formal process. And we believe that the two sides are equally important and equally complex. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have a training and a real measurable training on the personal side that matched the training on the technical side.
Sure.
And here's the kicker. Hmm. And if people get this, we all make decisions from the personal side.
Absolutely.
So it's crazy somehow that we... This just didn't get in the mix right from the very beginning, back in the late 70s when financial planning started. Mm-hmm. Or even earlier. But we really, and you know, now neuroscience and psychology and behavioral finance and cognitive bias and all that stuff is very popular. It's the buzz. Mm-hmm. But it's been embedded in client activity and behavior and communication and decision making since the beginning. Mm-hmm. So we're not trying to see something that nobody else sees. We're seeing what everybody is seeing, but we are challenging ourselves to think differently about what we see. Mm-hmm. And building process so that we can really develop some true skills and hopeful expertise on that personal side to match the technical. So it's not an either or for us. Mm-hmm. It's both. So the advisors can tell their story to a center of influence, to clients, to whomever they want to be speaking with. They can do it in 30 seconds. They can do it in 2 and 3 minutes. And it's so intuitive to the client. And they'll all say, well, hasn't it always been that way? Mm-hmm. How come this is new? And then they get to talk about their training and, mm-hmm. and why they stepped into this training, what drove them, what did they learn, and why it matters to the client. That's the close. It's called the new me story.
Well, and I love the fact that you've quantified and made it measurable, because I think that is the difficult side of the human aspect of financial services and financial planning, is it's gray, it's messy, everybody is so fundamentally different. And when you bring financial advisors into the messy aspect of it, those advisors who can handle that well are very successful in my experience. And so right. Those are the sorts of people that we would want to send to your training so that they can hone that skill, because relationship management, expectation, communication, all the things that you're talking about, you know, kind of the messy, dirty life stuff, that takes training. It's just like sharpening your saw and going to continuing educations on financial planning and updating, you know, tax law. You have to also learn and practice how to listen, how to ask the right questions, how to document it correctly, all of those different pieces. And if you're negligent in doing that and you don't exercise that muscle, you're not going to be as successful.
It's so true, Matt. It's some of us are just hardwired to be good communicators. We have the right personality to do the work that we do. People like us, we like them. And those people are successful Even, you know, in spite of markets and wherever they work, it doesn't matter what you know, if they're in a wirehouse or an RIA, they can be very successful. When that kind of advisor comes for training, what we hear over and over again is, oh my gosh, I've done something like this, but it hasn't been formalized. So now I'm so much better at it. Mm-hmm. Or I've been great at all this other and I forgot about that. Now mm-hmm. I have a process. So I can stay present. I have a process that fits with my CRM and my practice management. But the other part is really interesting, Matt, and you've met many of these advisors as well. People that are so earnest, they are so dedicated, but they just don't have the people skills. They're more of a quant kind of
person. Totally. Absolutely.
And they're terrific, and they have a very important role to play in all of this. But they, too, unless they're just running portfolios from a platform and they don't meet with real people, if you're meeting with real people, you kind of need these skills, even if it's not natural. So I'm so impressed when that kind of advisor shows up and says, okay, tell me what to do. And I can see the discomfort mm-hmm. in some of these in the beginning. But if they're willing to step into that discomfort, they get there. And all of a sudden, they have acquired these skills that haven't come to them very easily, but they're highly effective. And their businesses change. It's so great to see that transformation.
And I personally witnessed that too. And that being around for epiphanies is one of the greatest gifts I think any of us can have, right? As professionals. Well, I want everybody to have a chance to get to know you too, just a little bit as a human being. I mean, you've been on this planet for a little while. You're very well traveled, highly, highly educated. But when you look at what you've created with the Financial Transitionist Institute and the Sudden Money Institute, what are your goals? Like, what does Susan want to be when she grows up?
Oh, well, I've had to, as we all do, it's a good thing to review, right? As life moves along and mm-hmm. we move from stage to stage. And at this point, now that we have a textbook and we have the training and the certification, we have all of that going for us, I'm interested in building a 100-year-old business.
Wow.
In other words, I want this to last far longer than me. Mm-hmm. So now as I enter our enterprise stage, because we took a long time to build, we were in discovery, then we built a product, which you could call the certification. And now I want that certification to be known around the world. I want it to have the old-fashioned way would be sort of like the good housekeeping seal of approval to the public, like the CFP is. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to replace CFPs. In fact, to be, we call it a CEFT, to have our designation, you have to be a CFP or CIMA or CFA.
Okay.
So we want people to have expertise in their primary, their entry level anyway, of their business. And this is a post CFP training.
Okay.
So I don't want to replace CFP at all, but I want the public to recognize there are specialists mm-hmm. and I want people to know how to access wherever they are, if they're moderate wealth or high net worth or male, female, I don't care. We all need help in making change. Mm-hmm. And I think as I look forward and I think about the next two or three generations after me, and that's really who I'm thinking about these days. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that it becomes widespread so that this change dynamic that is picking up so much, it's so much more change now than when I started. The word transition was very rarely used. It was used in business coaching. Mm-hmm. So now it's very common to us. And these are times when people make critical decisions that affect the rest of their life, the quality of their life. And I just think collectively, if I wanted to go into the big picture, how do I put a drop in the ocean of saving the world? It would be to help people around the globe to make better choices as they go through life events so that each event takes them one step higher in their life. I think it's possible. And financial planners or advisors are the most ideal professionals on this planet to do it.
Yep.
They are uniquely suited. So I think I found my direction for my contribution. And I'm taking that, the sustainability of this, much more seriously than I did when we were in developmental mode.
Sure. Well, when you look at success, so you have a 100-year plan, right? Or your goal is to have, you know, this business last way past you. What does success look like? How does Susan Bradley look at herself in the mirror and say, okay, I am successful. Here's what I have achieved. Paint a picture for our audience, please.
That's nice. I really like thinking about other trainers in our organization worldwide who are able to give this knowledge and this continued experience to advisors. So it's independent of me. Obviously, I don't want to be running around the globe for the next 50 years, nor does anybody want to see me 50 years from now doing that. And maybe we all become omnipresent or something so we don't have to. But until then, I want to train other people to do it. The advisor in India, Labai Navlaki, he's a CFP and the first CEFT in India. I did 4 workshops with him. And I realized that he can handle a room and deliver the training as well as I can. It was a wonderful thing to see. So it frees me up and it allows me to put time and energy into that area because there's someone who wants to and can carry on.
Sure.
So I like to think about people like that all around. I like to see communities where we have people dedicated to mastery, not mastering. Mm-hmm. People that are into continuous learning. They're curious. They're paying attention. Things like exponential change don't freak them out. They don't white knuckle and try and resist it. They want to know about it. They want to know more. Mm-hmm. They want to integrate good ideas from there into their lives and the lives of their work. I love those people who are on that curious side of the equation. They give me energy to be around those conversations. I think we all give each other energy for that. And that's what sustains going forward. And it's really great to have plenty of time to be in Cape Cod with my family, my dad and several of my brothers. I'm from a family of 10. Mm. So we number somewhere in the low 50s right now in immediate family. So I enjoy being part of that, you know. I enjoy the mountains. I love to hike. I like to explore. I fell in love recently with the coast of California, an area that not so many people go to. And I found I love the trails there. It's easy out of San Francisco. Hmm. So it's great to explore the globe and have time like that with people that matter to me, that just sort of give me that warm, wonderful quality of life. So it's not all business for sure.
Fantastic. Well, so those people who you have in your life, who you've run across, who love those little nuggets and who love those ideas and who are open to learning, what is your go-to resource? I mean, do you have a book that you're like, man, you got to read this book? Or is it a podcast? Is it a TED Talk? What is your go-to resource client when you just meet somebody, you made a connection, you're like, I think you should blank this, listen to this, read this or whatever?
Oh, gosh, that changes. Way back in the very beginning, it was to refer people to William Bridges' work. He really is the pioneer in transition, and he was a coach a very successful coach for corporations, and he laid out a process. Our process is exactly the same but different because we're talking to different people. And I've always loved the name. Can you imagine being in the transition business with the last name of Bridges?
It's that's pretty perfect. Awesome. Good branding on that one.
So Bill Bridges was someone. Sometimes I've liked Simon Sinek's work with the Golden Circle. And I was just with a bank and trust company last week, and they were just discovering Simon Sinek. And so they were talking about why, you know, the power of why versus what you do and how you do it, why you do it. And it was great to see this body of work that we focused on many years ago and embedded in some of our process, see it discovered and used currently. So it keeps moving. I love TED Talks. Mm-hmm. I gave a TED Talk, which was the TEDx Talk, which was the most challenging thing I've done in a long time. Mm-hmm. And I like that whole community. I'm an original, not original, but I went to the TED conferences in Monterey, California, back in the late 90s, mm-hmm. early 2000, mm-hmm. when it was just one conference a year. Mm-hmm. It was a very closed group, but I managed to get invited somehow and discovered it. Mm. So they're the kind of people that are infinitely curious, yeah. and they hold high standards. So, I do share TED Talks frequently. Hmm. I love Dr. McGonigal's work on the upside of stress and that whole process of how people move through change and decisions. The idea of Dr. Carol Dweck's work on the growth mindset. We've actually embedded that into our process to take the mindset reset process, and we have looked at our tools and said, wow, they really do fit. Now we're more conscious when we're using them mm-hmm. of what we could do with them. Hmm. So it depends upon the year, the day. We're in ultimate discovery, but it's a great world out there. There are so many new things to discover every day you wake up.
Absolutely. And it's great to be flexible with that. I've had a couple of people who I've asked that question to who are actually quite rigid on, hey, I always recommend this. And I love it when it's fluid because education and knowledge is very, very fluid. When you think about your hero in life, the person you look up to, the person that you strive to be, who comes to mind?
And besides personal, family members, there are some that no one would know but me. I was lucky to have some inspirational grandparents, and my parents aren't too shabby. But outside, you know who I have followed and I just like their thinking is John Bogle at Vanguard.
Oh, okay.
I love how clean and straightforward that man is. I think his thinking has been important and probably is even more important today. So when I was coming in the profession back then, I did radio and I got a chance to interview him and I met him several times. And I just like the way he sees life. John Templeton. Was someone that it was not afraid to integrate his spiritual side with his business side. And he was quite magnificent in both areas. Mm-hmm. Hmm. So those were two. I'm grasping because I know that there are women that I say to myself when I see them in action, I want to be like them. And mm-hmm. I'm just not grabbing names.
Oh, that's okay. And in fact, that could be a great excuse for you and I to do another podcast as you continue. Like after everything is done with FINRA, I would love to have you back on so we can dive a little bit more deeply into the whole credentialing and certification process. But this is probably my favorite question that I ask the marketing experts that we bring on Top Advisor Marketing Radio, which is, what is the biggest lesson you wish advisors would learn?
I think it's to listen deeply. I think we all need to be better listeners. But when you get into a position of expertise, there seems to be a drop in listening. And we're trying to look at listening, deep listening, as an expertise. We actually test for that in our certification. We have a PhD in the whole test-taking area. It's called Applied Linguistics. And we are still working on it, but we have tested three times now on how to listen. And is listening without bias and without judgment, which is also almost humanly impossible. because we have what Margaret Hefferman calls willful blindness in her book. But to strive to that, to be aware of ourselves listening and hold the client in high regard, even if they're acting out like a real knucklehead. You get a lot of bad behavior when we go through transitions, and it's easy to judge a client. And it's really lovely to not judge the client. It gives them so much more room to move out of that behavior. But that's a, it's a very squishy thing, as that's your technical term, but
yeah,
I love it.
It's very technical, by the way. Yeah.
So I would like advisors in general to build awareness of the human struggles that can happen, around being, tired and not being ready, being depleted and not having their full cognitive capabilities, and to listen to them and find the one place that you can step in and make it easier for that client, or safer,
sure,
or faster or slower, or whatever it, you know, it can be done to move forward, even if it's moving backwards to take a rest.
Well, unfortunately, most advisors and salespeople are one, taught to never ask a question you don't know the answer to. And number two, most of us listen to respond, not to listen. And so I'm very, very glad that you do that. You know, I think listening, again, is a muscle or a skill that one needs to exercise. And thank you for bringing that into your program, because and I do this all the time. I even do this on podcasts. I'll start with a question, and then I'll let my guest talk, and they will end up somewhere that they didn't think they were going to end up. And they'll say to me after we get done recording, "Wow, Matt, I really kind of ended up somewhere I didn't really think I was going to." And that's because my goal, as well as I think all advisors' goals should be give your client, the person who's sitting across from you, the space to be able to process what they're saying, and a comfortable environment to make sure that they can communicate effectively. So brilliant, brilliant. And I would love to take a look at that test. Maybe you and I should talk about that a little bit more offline. Okay. What is the, if you had $1 billion, would you do anything differently?
Yes. Of course I would.
Okay. Well, tell us what you would do differently.
Holy cow, that's the funniest thing that people always tell me when lotteries used to come and do some work a lot when Sudden Money first came out. I kind of discouraged that now. I can't tell you how many times people say, "I don't want to change my life." Hello, your life has changed. You know, what are you going to do now? So, yeah, of course I would. I would have great pleasure in doing some significant, I don't know if you'd call it philanthropy. Sometimes that's a big word, but I would really like to put some real money energy into projects that I care about. That would give me tremendous pleasure.
Okay.
So, yeah, I would. And I'd probably buy a house on Lake Winnipesaukee for family tribal gatherings, as
nice.
We do.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe one near the everybody in Cape Cod. So, you know, things that I'll probably do anyway. If I had $1 billion, I might do it a little bit bigger, but it wouldn't be significant.
Yeah. Well, if you could choose one superpower, and now this is a superpower, what would you choose?
I don't know. Omnipresence is pretty good. I said that word for some reason before. That's being in many places at once, but that could be confusing. Flying. I love, my favorite dreams are to fly.
Nice.
When I dream that I'm flying, I wake up happy. I wake myself up laughing when I'm flying. So yes, I would fly. That's what I would do.
An omnipresent flyer would be fantastic. That would, I haven't used those two words together as evidence how hard that was for me to get it out. All right. Favorite musical artist and why? So music can be one of those things that we use to recenter ourselves and to energize ourselves, or maybe even process stuff. What is your favorite musical artist and why?
Yeah, there are some that have stayed with me. I like a lot of the new music. I like some of Eric Clapton's bluesy stuff, because I think it, I don't know, somehow it hits me right. And some of the lyrics are fun. My favorite album for a long time was Riding with the King. B.B. King and Eric Clapton. So that's kind of what I used to listen to a lot. I really love what I see out of Adele, and I know that's almost, she's almost a cliche. She's gotten so high so fast. Mm-hmm. But I like how she kind of challenges status quo a lot. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of doing it her way. And that's a cool thing to watch.
Yeah.
And the music is great. It's a little bit sad, you know?
Yes, I would agree with that.
But she's got great range and all that. Wow. When I hear other people try and do Adele, you realize how good she is.
Yeah.
But I like that she's looking at life differently and probably giving permission to a lot of young women. Mm-hmm. To not be perfect, body shape and that mm-hmm. kind of thing, mm-hmm. and not accept some of the status quo out there. So I think she's a great role model.
One of my friends went to see her recently in Detroit, and she got done singing a couple of songs, and she stopped and she said, "If you honestly think I'm going to sing for 2 hours straight, you're crazy. We're going to talk," right? Which I thought was really cool, and the whole audience went crazy because, you know, it ended up making the concert very intimate. I love that you brought her up. Yeah, she's truly an amazing performer. But when you were a kid, so think back, and I know just a few years ago when you were, you know, 10 or 12 and you were thinking, man, you know what, this is what I want to be when I grow up. What did you want to be?
Well, I was programmed, being second oldest of 10, and our family was well known in the town we grew up in. And the whole world assumed that I would marry and have a lot of children. So I was kind of raised to be a breeder. but my real heart was in exploring. So what I really dreamed of, my favorite subject was geography. I love learning about countries and looking at the globe and looking at how mountains were formed. And that's what really intrigued me. And I wanted to know what it smelled like and looked like and felt like in other countries. And no one in my family except my great-grandparents were world travelers.
Hmm.
So, you know, they all did great stuff, and they were well-educated and blah, blah, blah. And it was my great-great-grandfather that traveled to Europe every summer to find artisans to make the jewelry that he made for Tiffany's.
Wow.
So, that was, and that's pretty far removed. I never met him. So it wasn't really in my family, except my grandmother and her sisters traveled with their father. So I heard some stories, but my first trip was with one of my childhood friends, and we took off to Europe and went backpacking and hitchhiking.
Hmm.
That kind of blew all the circuits at home. But, you know, and that's always been out there for me. I was in suburbia, mm-hmm. very nice suburbia, excellent, 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 you know, but it didn't fit me.
Hmm.
So anyway, well, tell me more than you want to know.
Oh, no, that's absolutely fantastic. I absolutely love that. As you do with working with people in transition, understanding their foundation on how they make the decisions that they do, and a lot of that really does go back to being, you know, looking back at your childhood. I don't know if you know this, Susan, but I started my professional career actually as a therapist. So I'm a huge fan of diving and digging deep, and that's why I call it squishy and messy, because, you know, that's really what life is. And speaking of messy, you know, all of us make mistakes in life, and obviously, whatever mistakes you have made, you have allowed yourself to really grow, or you wouldn't be this wonderful person we're interviewing today. But if you wouldn't mind, tell us what your biggest failure was or mistake and what you learned from it.
Oy, that could take a while. You know, I was talking to one of my nieces about this recently. She's building her professional career in Boston. And I said, my biggest regret, my biggest mistake, I guess I could say, is I didn't ask enough questions. I was afraid to show that I didn't know the answers. And I thought that I was supposed to know everything, or that I was really not smart and people would find out if I asked questions. Mm-hmm. And asking questions is really one of the greatest ways to learn in life. So I think I slowed my progress quite a bit with that reluctance to ask questions. And I just started to realize that in the last couple of years. Now, I think I started asking questions much sooner than that. But when I was looking back and wondering why it took me so long to go from here to there or whatever, a lot of it was not knowing and not asking. Or maybe I wasn't open to people telling me. I'm not sure. But not asking questions was a real weak point. I wish I could have allowed someone to instill that confidence in me to ask questions when I was a child. They were such great people. I'm sure that they would have if they realized it was a need. But men were raised to know the answers, and women were raised not to know the answers.
Sure.
And the baby boom generation doesn't serve either generation at all. It kind of messes things up. But somehow I felt like I was supposed to know by the time I was in my 20s, particularly in the financial planning world. You know, you're an expert, so you're supposed to know. Mm-hmm. And back in the 80s, we were all kind of new at it, and nobody really knew.
Right, right.
Except the, you know, the mutual fund wholesalers. They always knew.
Yeah, they always had the answers, didn't they? Absolutely. Huh.
They have gotten much better, by the way.
Well, what is the best way for people to contact you? So they've heard the podcast and they're like, man, I totally want to learn more about the Financial Transitionist Institute. I want to, you know, have a chance to learn and to have a, what is the best way for people to reach out and get your information?
Well, we still use suddenmoney.com as our website. We're in the name-changing process now for the first half of this year. So suddenmoney.com.
Okay.
I'm on LinkedIn. And my email address is easy. It's susan@suddenmoney.com. Any of the above would be great. And I like conversation. I'd be happy to hear what people are thinking and wondering about and what are their questions.
Mm-hmm. And your LinkedIn presence is awesome, by the way. You know, there's a lot of thought leadership there. You do respond, which is cool. I've seen you respond to other people's comments on an article or a post that you make. And I think that was one of the reasons I felt very comfortable reaching out to you is because you do come across as being very welcoming and very approachable. And a person who's had the level of success that you have for so long, I personally want to thank you for taking the time not only to be on the podcast today, but also sharing that feeling that I've also heard from other people.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. I've enjoyed the conversation very much, Matt. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Top Advisor Marketing Podcast brought to you by Advisor Content X. My name is Matt Halloran for Susan Bradley. Remember, if you don't have a great brand and great marketing, you only contribute to the noise in our industry. Rise above the noise and become a top advisor.